The world's best don't get results alone, and now neither do you, no matter when, where, or what you're working on. Introducing Pit Stop's AI Avatar Marketplace. Think of it like Spotify, but for personal and professional growth. Imagine instant access to digital versions of the world's top coaches, each one trained on their unique methods, experience, and coaching style. This isn't just another chatbot. Every Pit Stop AI avatar is powered by real coach insights, their notes, their podcasts, and what they've learned from real sessions. It's a truly personalized coaching companion, so much smarter and more relevant than generic tools like ChatGPT. Whether you want to level up in business, build new habits, manage stress, or boost your confidence, you're not just getting advice, you're getting it directly from the playbook of proven high achievers, all at a fraction of the cost of traditional coaching and available 24/7 whenever you need that extra edge. Ready to find the coach that you need? Use Pit Stop as your launchpad for growth. Head to the link in the show notes and download the app now.
Welcome to Drive to Thrive, a Pit Stop podcast. My name is Sandy and I am your host. And this week I'm joined by Dr. Benjamin Ritter. Ben is a leadership and career coach and is the founder of Live For Yourself Consulting. He's based in Austin, Texas, and he basically helps people improve their careers, become better leaders. These are such important things to think about. We spend so much time thinking about our careers, and often we lack the advice and the coaching needed to help us really optimize what we're doing for a living. And that was what we got into with Ben today. So it's some of the most impactful pieces of advice that he's given and received, how we can make our career our own and, you know, impart that self-leadership within ourselves. You know, nobody's coming to save us. And that's a big thing that Ben speaks about. He talked about why rejection isn't personal, it's information, and how we can take that and use that and help us to power and fuel our growth. Why fear is so important when it comes to our career and how we can start to mitigate that. We talked about his managing to motivate model, what that is, and how more leaders and teams can adapt to it. How you can adapt when you're going from a doing role into something a bit more strategic, taking on the leadership and working and helping, guiding, coaching other people. All in all, this was a really valuable conversation. Lots of great insights from Dr. Benjamin. I hope that you guys enjoy. Dr. Benjamin Rare, Ben, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure. Many variations of Ben, Ben, Benji, Benjamin, Benjamin, Dr. Benjamin, Ben. Did I say Benny yet? I don't know. Ritz.
You said Ritter. Benny, I think.
Yeah. And I was actually thinking of like my old nicknames. I had Neckbone once because I started complaining to the teacher that my neck hurt. And then, you know, be careful what you complain about because it could become your nickname for 5 years. So
kids latch on to some funny things, don't they?
They do. They do.
Kicking off is the question I always ask every coach as soon as they come on. What is the best piece of coaching advice that you've ever received?
Yeah, well, coaching changed my life. I was selected for a 16-month leadership training program when I was an unbelievably actively disengaged victim of my career and leadership around me. And it was the first time I ever experienced coaching. And I didn't really know it was coaching at the time. It was a guy that I trusted that created a safe space and asked me a bunch of questions and then challenged me on my mindset and helped me reframe kind of where I was. And I don't think he really gave me this advice, but it was like the theme underneath the advice that coaching tends to create, like it plants seeds. And as we watered that seed, the greatest coaching that sent me on this path was if all you believe about your job is that it's wrong, then you prevent any opportunity to make it right. And it was like this unbelievable mind shift to being the victim, to being empowered and accountable. And honestly, I think as I think about that even further, it's the foundation of self-leadership. It's the foundation of becoming fearless. It's the foundation of living for yourself, which is everything that I promote and teach nowadays.
Has that informed the kind of advice that you give then? You know, I've asked you what the best piece of coaching advice you've received. What about the best piece of coaching advice that you've found yourself giving out to others?
Yeah, you are the most important leader that you'll ever meet in your entire life. And just this idea of self-leadership. It's the idea that, like, if you want your leader to be somebody different, you need to be that person first. It's the idea that no matter what tools you have in front of you, you have to figure out how to survive on the island. It's like, I think about this idea of like being dropped on this desert island and being like, you have a piece of string, you have a coconut, you know, you have a needle, and maybe you have like, I don't know, a bandana. Now live, survive. It's like, what are you going to do? Complain? Oh, I can't believe I have a bandana and a coconut. No, you're going to be like, okay, shoot. So I can maybe put a hole in this coconut. I can like put the string through it. I now have like a mace. And I can use that mace to like hit a parrot, and now I can eat, you know, and then I can use those feathers to create clothes. Like, it's like you use the things that you have. You have to be the person that's motivating you to take control of your environment, and then to intentionally live towards the things that you want to create.
I saw a quote that you said when I was doing my research for this, and it was, make your career yours because no one else will. And I think that kind of pertains to what you were just saying there, but in a slightly different prism. And yeah. I'd love to know what that quote means to you.
We often, like the world has this underlying belief that, and it's changing, but go to school, get a degree, work some sort of job, take what you can. You know, it's this responsiveness, right? It's this reactivity to your career and to your job. I will get a promotion because I work hard. I will get the feedback I need to be successful. Jobs will just come to me. And it's not. Like, maybe for a little bit, but I can't tell you how many professionals I've met since 2020, when the world kind of changed pretty drastically, that were in the same job for a decade. And then they were in like five, like they were in a job every year because like they got laid off and they got laid off and they got laid off, and they were just kind of like taking the job that came to them. Then they realized they took a job that didn't really matter to them. They're not at the title that they want. They don't have the experience that they want. They have no projects to talk to. And now because of that reactivity, they have zero self-confidence. They have no idea what they want to do. They doubt themselves unbelievably. And they're just showing up to life instead of figuring out how to actually intentionally show up. And so if you don't make your career yours, somebody else will, and it's not going to be a place where you want to be, at least eventually. Maybe now it is, but in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, it won't be. And when I was early on in my career, I had a lot of disappointments happen to me. So like, if you did your research, you probably know that I wanted to be a professional soccer player first. That failed. I was a nutrition major. They canceled it. I then worked in health policy, and they cut federal funding, and I lost my job. And then over a span of 2.5 to 3 years, I got 4 different job offers, and each offer was canceled after signing the contract. It was just, they decided to pull the job. And so I networked into healthcare. I like found my way eventually into it. What actually ended up happening is I networked a nurse into a position, into an ICU, through this nurse manager. That nurse manager then, so I got a friend a job, and then got me an interview for another job. They didn't hire me because I was making money at the time as a bartender. They're like, oh, we bartenders, we don't want to hire him. Got to the final round, one of the chief executives didn't want me in because it was very traditional. Could tell you why I eventually had some terrible experiences with leadership. And then about a year later, they took that guy, they sent him to go train to become the CEO of the hospital. They brought me back. Like, oh, we like that Ben guy. They brought me back. They hired me because he wasn't there. And then he came back and then he promoted me, which is hilarious. But I ended up in healthcare, unbelievable, like not because I chose it, but because I was defeated and because I fell into it through like happenstance and survival mode. And so it makes sense though that like, because I didn't believe I owned it, because it wasn't based on clarity, because I didn't feel like I had control over my career anymore, that eventually over time, a bunch of muck starts developing that you feel lost, you feel stuck, you don't feel confident, you give up. And so making your career yours means like that doesn't happen. Like you're intentionally making every choice. You're creating opportunities for yourself. You feel accountable for your career success, and you don't believe that anyone owes you anything. And so you go earn it.
Talk to me about the role of fear within that then. This is something that you speak about a lot. I think for anyone listening to what you just said there, the first thing they go is like, well, how do I get past that first step? And often I think that first step is fear, and it's a fear of the unknown, especially when there's money involved and things like that. And, you know, you've got like Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V, for anyone not sure, you know, he's an entrepreneur and things, and his whole USP, like he posts all this content. He's like, you're 36, you're a baby. It doesn't matter. You know, I was working in my dad's wine shop when I was 34, and, you know, you don't need to do it. And it's all well and good hearing that. But a lot of the time, you know, it's different thinking you need to start a new career at 36 compared to when you're 22 and just starting, you know? And I think each of those situations carries their own kind of different fears. So what do you think the role of fear is, and how can someone get past that initial concern of stepping out of the comfort zone and trying to start something new, and essentially from that taking ownership?
Mm-hmm. I had a little bit of a gift, because in soccer, I wasn't the best. And I learned that to be better, I had to work harder. So I couldn't be the best, but I could work harder than everybody else. And so I learned at an early age about discomfort. This is like the David Goggins. We're throwing Gary Vee and David Goggins. It's like, I will go outside. I make a commitment to myself to be outside running in the rain, in the snow, on the ice, no matter if I'm like, you choose that being uncomfortable is a commitment, is a part of life to help you achieve a goal. And so I know for a fact that I had those experiences. Most people don't. Not most, but like some people don't. And so if you've never been uncomfortable, if you've never decided that you're going to go for a run in the rain because you decided to go for a run, that you're going to not eat for a day because you're practicing fasting, you haven't pushed yourself physically through a limit, or maybe even mentally, like you're going to meditate for an hour or stare at a wall, or what do they call it now in an airplane where you don't like read a book or
raw dog in it or something.
Yeah, raw dog in it. Like if you haven't tested yourself mentally and built that level of resilience, any level of discomfort, like think about this. If you've never gone on a run or never worked out at all, and now you're 38 and someone tells you to go run, the moment your heart starts to beat fast, the moment you start to sweat, you're going to be scared. Like you're going to be like, what is happening to me? Am I dying? And I can say this because I know someone that's happened to. And for me, I was like actually working out with them, and I was like, they're like, oh no, my heart's beating too fast. I feel like I'm hyperventilating. I think something's wrong. And I was like, hold on a second. What's your heart rate at? Like, this is normal. This is your body doing something new. And so like this idea of fear, it comes up whenever we try something new that's uncomfortable in our lives. And so when you're experiencing fear, are you just experiencing your heart speeding up, something completely natural and normal from the activity that you're doing because it's new to you? More likely, yes. Fear is just information, it's data. If we haven't done it before, or we've been told that it's something bad, we're going to interpret it negatively. And so for example, like if I'm considering changing my career, one of the fears that might come up is I'm gonna have to start over. Okay, that's a fear. I'm not gonna be successful. Okay, that's a fear. I'm going to not make any money. Okay, that's a fear. But this is just data and information. How you interpret it matters. I'm not going to have any money. Okay, well, let's break that down. How much money are you going to earn? How much money will you earn on this journey? How much money do you think you earn? Will need to earn? What are some other ways you can earn money? And actually, like, how much money can you save so that you feel more comfortable taking this step? And you can walk through logically any of this data and information that we're getting from fear. What people tend to do, though, is they say, I feel fear. I feel something negative. And because I feel something negative, that means this is bad. That means that I have to stop. And so what we try to interrupt in the book, Becoming Fearless, that I wrote, it really motivates people towards action and learning that from the feeling of fear, which is just information, instead of stopping, you actually start processing. And through that processing, eventually will come some sort of small action. Through that sort of small action comes a little bit of realization that you're going to be okay. It builds confidence. It says, okay, because I feel fear doesn't mean I need to stop. It means I have to figure out actually what I'm going to do because of this fear. So then I can learn that there's nothing to be afraid of. And then I can actually start growing past that fear.
I love what you said at the beginning about discomfort. There's a British, an endurance athlete, a guy called Ross Edgley. And he does, you know, crazy stuff, like he just swam up the whole Yukon and, you know, kind of does all that like David Goggins kind of stuff. And one of the things he says is like, everybody should have their daily dose of discomfort. And actually it's having discomfort in the short term will save you discomfort in the long term. You know, not eating the candy bar today means in X amount of, you know, months, years time, you're not going to be sat on the sofa unable to get off it because you're too overweight and too unfit and you're diagnosed with diabetes or whatever. So actually getting off the sofa now and being uncomfortable for that hour, going for that run or exercising, like you said, suddenly that prepares your, essentially sets the bar higher for your stress response. So as soon as you're out of breath or you're nervous because you've got a work presentation the next day or anything like that, suddenly your stress response is up here, or sorry, is down here rather than up here. Because your baseline of discomfort that you're used to dealing with is much, much higher. Does that make sense?
Are you willing to deal with the discomfort of today to avoid the pain of tomorrow? And when it comes to our career, the discomfort of today. So if you're job searching, spending an hour, sending outbound messages, networking, having conversations with people that you don't know, probably the first couple being really terrible and bad because you're learning how to do it. You're learning what works. You're learning what doesn't. Are you okay with spending an hour applying for positions, or is okay spending an hour researching an industry maybe that you don't know a lot about? The discomfort of today, because alternative, and these might not sound that scary or uncomfortable, but they're real issues that people tend to have. Confronting that your brand might not be good enough and rebranding yourself. But are you willing to do that instead of watch a streaming service or go get a pint at the local bar or to go on another meaningless date, right? It's like, it's, or to sit at home and just do nothing. And whatever it is that makes you feel good, that's your routine that is keeping you from the life that you want. Are you willing to deal with the tough conversation with your manager about expectations and feedback and accountability and promotions? Like all these things that might seem just like normal actions towards to achieving your goals are really scary to a lot of people. And if someone's listening to this, I imagine some of these are probably coming up for you. But if you got past it, if you had that conversation, or if you sent that networking message, you'd realize, oh, that wasn't that bad.
Something else you've said as well is, I don't know why this really latched onto and really resonated with me. And that's, rejection isn't personal, it's information. And I think that's such a powerful statement, because oh, man's up, like I've, you know, whether it's a job offer or a romantic relationship or whatever it is, like for some reason, we always do take it personally, don't we?
Mm-hmm. I would love, and this is what I try to teach with clients. It's you're your most important leader. So what does that mean? It means that around, like imagine like a bubble around you. It's like a filter. And so let's say you get rejected. You're trying to achieve something. You get a no. Okay, so that no comes in. Most people, or okay, I shouldn't say most people. People, this rejection comes in and it like pervades into their system. Like it like sucks into their identity. Like, oh, this person said no, so I am meaningless. I am worthless. I am not good enough. Everything I'm doing in life should change because of this one person's opinion. This person who is their entire universe of self. Like they've had their own experiences, they have their own goals, they have their own intentions. They are not you. They are a unique human individual with an opinion. And we take that and we go, their opinion is me. I'm terrible. Self-leadership is their opinion comes in and it stays in front of you. And kind of like a minority report, you start like spinning it around, you like make it bigger, you make it smaller, you explore it, you examine it. And you're like, what parts of this do I want to actually think about? What parts of this do I want to believe? What parts of this can help me achieve my goals? What parts of this are meaningless, are worthless, are something that, and by the way, this isn't about truth. This is what parts of this help me become the person I want to be and achieve the goals that I'm working towards. Not truth, not false, not good, not bad. How do I use this to grow? And so if that person's opinion is this entire environment and ecosystem of opinions, and you have to merge and adapt to that because you want to access that environment, great. That becomes truth. Now you have to live it and adapt to it and change. But if it's like, oh, this person's over here and I'm never going to see them again or talk to them again, and it doesn't really matter, you can completely disregard it. And we just like forget that. Like it's so like self-leadership is believing that who you are is more important than who someone else thinks you are. And who you are only truly matters based on what you want to achieve.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's so easy to get caught up in not just how others feel about you, but like you said, how you think others feel about you. And often, what we quickly realize as well, I used to have this written on a post-it note on the back of my bathroom door, and it was, nobody's thinking about you as much as you think they are. Because I think so often, and especially, you know, for me personally, but also the conversations I've had, like especially in a work situation, I think because there is that added pressure to it of you want to perform and you want to do well. And so often there's another conversation entirely, but we tie our self-worth to our careers and our jobs, don't we? You know, we think that's everything that we should be doing. And I think, therefore, we take into account a lot more what our peers think, what our bosses think, you know, and it's really difficult. And often, especially like when you get stuck in a career as well, and you start to realize, you know, like you said, realizing what you want, that changes over time as well, doesn't it? You know, compared to what you want when you're 25 versus what you want when you're 30 versus 35 and so on and so on, changes massively. And how do you help people navigate that as well? You know, when someone's doing well in a career and they've got to the point, maybe they don't care what other people think, but and they've got that self-leadership and inside they're like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. They feel a bit stuck. They're lacking maybe that purpose and fulfillment. What can someone do when they start to get into that sort of thought pattern, when they start to get that self-leadership where they've got the self-awareness, but they don't necessarily know where to go next?
So self-leadership is a combination of clarity. So I know who I am. I know where I want to go. Confidence. I believe in myself and my capabilities to be able to get there. And control, the idea that we can only control what we can. So our environments, our energy, resources we have, what we learn, like it's, I'm showing up in a way that's intentional towards those things. And so if we start doubting what we're working on, so we have to go to clarity and kind of re-examine it. Like, what is causing us to doubt where we're currently at? Let's explore that, the fear, whatever it is. And then take a look at like, well, who am I? Like, have I changed? Like, what are my values? What are the things that I hold dear to myself? What are the things that I believe are important in my life? What are the things that I maybe want to be important in my life? And am I working on those things? Like, is my current job allowing me to do those things? Am I doubting my organization? Am I doubting my leader? Am I doubting because I got some feedback? Or am I doubting because I started caring about things differently? And so if that's the case, then maybe we have to reset some goals and say, like, am I showing up in a way that aligns with who I am at my core? Am I working towards things that I believe are important? Am I involved in them? And so often we get stuck because we get one experience with a leader, we get one piece of feedback, or something changes about our relationships or our life that makes us doubt ourselves. And so that doubt can be real or can be false. And we kind of have to go back to clarity and go back to the basics and spend some time in reflection again.
How easy is that though? And what can they do when that does come from an external source? I mean, I've had it myself, and I know, you know, you said earlier, you had it like when you have had a really negative experience with a bad boss or something like that, that kind of fully makes you not only question what you do, but also like who you are. And actually, am I a piece of shit? You know, am I not worthy of all of this? I'm sure that's something that probably resonates with other people. You know, is there like a tangible kind of first step? You know, you said kind of come back to that clarity and question that. Does that mean literally kind of taking some time off if you can? Or does that mean X amount of time a day spent on this? Like what does that actually tangibly look like?
We put a lot of pressure on ourselves to have clarity all the time, to feel good all the time. Like, you get laid off, go through some shit, right? Have a hard time. You got to process it. You got to give yourself some time to vent, to reminisce, to doubt. Like our expectations of self have to change. There needs to be a timeline. Okay, so I just got laid off from a job. I need to take a month to process this. I need to take a week to process this. I need to make money. Okay, so I'm going to go do something to make money. But I have to know that like I'm going to not believe in myself as much for a while. It's truth. It just happens because our brain is like processing the trauma that we had. You see that a lot with a lot of layoffs that are happening or a negative performance review. I work with a lot of leaders just on leadership development, and it's like, yeah, you're going to get disengagement from your employees no matter what. You can't avoid that, but it's better to give the feedback and to allow that to happen and to allow them to process it. You can't change it. You're not responsible for that disengagement. Like it's just going to happen. And so when we have something terrible happen to us, it makes us doubt ourselves. We have to accept the fact that we're going to doubt ourselves. It's a natural progression of interpreting information and processing that. Like, I don't know how many times you might have had something bad happen to you or had a conflict happen with a friend or a relationship. and then go to bed. And like before you went to bed, it was like the end of the world. Like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like by the time you went to sleep and then you woke up in the morning, you're like, oh, okay, my brain did this thing. Like it cleaned out the gunk. Like I'm feeling better. So that happens in our life, but it's not always 24 hours. It can be longer. So first, let yourself process. So what does that mean? It means do the things that would usually make you happy, but might not make you as happy now. So I'm going to still show up to the gym. I'm going to still read the book that I enjoy. I'm still going to go for a walk. I'm still going to see some friends. I'm still going to go volunteer at the thing that I want to volunteer at, because giving tends to help create some sort of joy. So we create a positive environment for ourselves. So we feel good. And while we're processing, and then, like, because a lot of the things I'm saying, you're like, it really isn't easy. None of this stuff is easy. None of this stuff is simple. I'm saying things that have taken me a decade, you know, or more to learn. Like each one of my journeys was like 4 years of practicing and learning and then reiterating and 4 years of practicing, learning, and reiterating. But if we've now spent some time processing and we've created an environment that brings us a little bit of joy, then we can sit back and go reflect. Then we can go process the situation. You can't process the situation when you're in high emotional state. You just can't. Mm-hmm. Your brain's not ready to do that. So then you can go back and say, well, what do I really care about? Like, does this person's opinion change who I am at my core? And who am I? Who I want to be? And am I showing up as that person? Did this situation maybe cut some chinks out of my armor of who I think I am? Like, does it change? Did I do something inauthentic? Did I do something that wasn't intentional towards my values? And then you start processing that situation. This is where a coach comes in that can be really helpful, or an AI coach. And you take the moment and then you start saying, okay, so if I now know who I am based on these situations and who I don't want to be, because the things that actually make us frustrated or angry really hint at our values too, then based on this now and based on the current situation, based on what's happened, what is available to me to take? What sort of action can I take now? What goals can I set that will reinforce this sense of self and who I am? And so to summarize that, it's process, create fun and joy and feed yourself in a positive way. Then reflect on, well, who am I still? What does this situation say about me? What have I learned about it? And now what actions can I take with what's available to me to reinforce that belief?
And also, you know, in this day and age, everything's so instant. Attention spans, you know, social media, things like that. So we are kind of wired these days to think that everything happens immediately, so that then, and I've caught myself doing this, when something bad does happen, I expect it to be fixed by the next day, or, you know, even that later on that day, I'm like, cool, I'll be done. I'll be sorted by then, you know? And I think it's so great that you highlighted, like, no, this takes a while. Like, you have to do it. And I think the same thing with career and things like that. A lot of people these days think, you know, you do a couple of months and then you're promoted, and a couple more months and you're promoted again. And, you know, a year and a half down the line, suddenly your whole world looks different and you're halfway towards being an executive level. And actually stepping back and realizing, like, I'm, you know, this is a 5-year journey, 10-year journey, not a 1-year journey. And I think that gets a lot of people stuck as well. And I think sometimes, I think we second guess because it's taking a while, we second guess it. And actually we're on the right path, but we just get a bit impatient.
Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with a friend yesterday who's going through some career troubles. And, you know, some things are kind of just battles that people face. Like, he's a young professional, early 30s, trying to sell himself to founders that are in their 50s and 60s. And they're like, look, you're going to deal with some ageism. So with that, you have to think about branding. You have to think about titles. You have to think about, what are the things I can do this year, next year, in 3 years to be the person that I want to be in 5 years or 8 years? And I even shared my own story. Like, when I was, you know, first an executive leader coach, talking to these CEOs that are also just, you know, 20, 30, 40 year experienced executives, I'm not who they want to work with. And it's like, well, then what can I do this year or next year and the year after that and the year after that to become that person? And my doctorate took 3 years. Most people's university educations take 4. Most jobs even seem credible within the space or a field from a title basis take anywhere from 3 to 4 to 5. And you have people jumping job to job every 2 years, every year and a half. Well, that's going to create some bias against you. And it's like you're operating in alignment with rules that exist within an environment. And like, so what are those rules? What are those expectations? And how do you lean into that and feed into that? And we're working with another individual that's trying to pivot their career. And it's like, great, just remember, you're now starting over. And when you start over, that takes time. So your expectations of being at this level really need to be lower here at this level. But that's okay, because you're learning something new. Let's find the joy in learning. And if you work harder than people maybe in this career that are just going into work each and every single day, shooing it in because they already have the background in it, you probably could end up being at a higher level, more a higher level of seniority than them. Immerse yourself in the podcast on the industry. Read all the books that the thought leaders in that space are writing. Go do some extra work for a company. Go to events that relate to that industry. And there is so much that we can do to be successful that we don't do because of the fear, the discomfort, the wanting really other things. And so if you find out that maybe you don't want those things, be okay with it. Be okay with the time that it takes to do it slower and not as much.
I think a lot of it as well is the fear of looking stupid. Maybe a couple of episodes ago, I had someone on and we were talking about this. It was an executive coach, a guy called Steve Davies, who worked in London for like 25 years for a VC firm, all this, super successful guy. And he was saying this, so often, actually, when you're in the early stages of your career, that's when you need to be asking the stupid questions. But that's when you're most scared to ask the stupid questions, because you're still quite junior and you don't want to look stupid. When you get a bit older and more experienced, you can be a bit more direct and ask what people would consider kind of simple, stupid questions. But when you're first starting out, you really need to be asking those questions. And actually, I think the people that get ahead are those ones who go, look, I'm removing ego from this. I don't mind if people think I'm asking a dumb question, but the information I gain is more valuable than me looking slightly foolish in front of peers or even other people. And what Steve said is often actually, the more senior members, the people being asked the questions, will appreciate that person more. They will appreciate that someone's being upfront and open enough to be like, look, I just need to know this information so that I can go and do it. And they're often the ones, I think, that will get further ahead than someone who's scared of looking stupid, essentially. And that was a really interesting take. I hadn't necessarily thought about it like that before.
It's funny you brought up ego, because any substance that is being promoted and advocated for in terms of the mental health world creates ego death, gets rid of your ego. I would love to get rid of our ego. Your ego is not going to serve you in your career or in your life. Ego compares yourself to others. Ego thinks that you're better than others. It takes you away from this internal sense of self and makes it more important what other people think. Looking stupid. How many people are in the world? If I had to look stupid to grow and to learn and to become the person that I wanted to be, I'll go look stupid. When I was learning how to build confidence and become social and all that kind of stuff, I still do it now. A lot of my humor is looking stupid sometimes. Why? Because I have this joke. I'm doing this joke inside me. I know what's really happening. They don't. And that is hilarious, because I get to live their reaction. And if their reaction is somehow hurt, degrading who I am within their eyes, that's kind of funny. I don't care. It's what matters about what they think about me? Nothing. Now, if you're in a corporate environment and you're worried about getting promoted or moving up, and it's kind of toxic and you don't really trust the people that are there. I could see some fear. I get your fear. Maybe build a trusted partner. Maybe then share it with that person. But most leaders around you want to hear your questions. They want you to lean into them as a mentor. They want to feel like they're giving to someone that's there. And we live in a day and age too where we have a lot of really smart AI tools that you can ask anything to and then still ask your question. So it's if we hold back something that we want to ask, right? That's fear. We're holding ourselves back. And if we do that consistently, can you imagine what kind of life you're not going to have?
Something you've talked about a lot is the managing to motivate model. I did a bit of research on this, but I was actually, sometimes I'm like, I don't want to do too much research because I want to actually hear about it on the podcast. But can you talk through kind of what that is and how leaders and teams can kind of adopt it a bit more?
Yeah, I have the opinion of sell the thing and then create it. And the team model of managing to motivate is one of those things. And it's funny how that became actually like a cornerstone of a lot of the stuff that I teach today. The team model of managing to motivate takes into account that leaders don't control their team. They control the environment around their team. And so what leaders are responsible for is creating environments. And I think what we are responsible for, creating environments that serve our goals and will more than likely motivate us to do that, do the things, to take action. And so I was doing a free workshop for the city of Chicago, and everyone left my workshop and there's a lot of energy in the room. And one of the like chiefs within the government within Chicago was walking by and he's like, what just happened? Why is everyone so excited and happy? It's usually pretty quiet here. And they're like, well, Ben just did a workshop. And they're like, who's this Ben guy? Get into my office. And they called me as I was walking downstairs, and I was like, yeah, I'll come back up, talk to this dude. And he's like, so do you do like leadership workshops? And I was like, yeah, what do you need? He's like, well, we have some disengagement here. I said, oh, great, I'll create something for you. And so then I went back to the research and I put this model together based on what I believe is important about leadership. And so hence the team model of managing to motivate was born. And so basically the team model of managing to motivate starts with trust. If you don't have trust, no one's going to actually do anything that you want them to do. They're not going to feel safe enough to lean into the work. And so if you don't have trust, I'm sorry, like you have to build trust first. Trust comes from a variety of things. It comes from people knowing what to expect when you're in a room. So reliability and credibility. It comes from you following up and following through. It comes from your just overall, like them trusting the information you're sharing. So you're an expert within the space. Comes from you supporting them, comes from them knowing what your vision is so they know what to expect, et cetera. So let's say you work on trust. That's like the main pillar. And we don't have time to like go into how to build trust, but let's say you have trust. Then you're responsible for the environment around your team. So do they have the tools they need? Virtual? Do they have a camera? Do they have a microphone? Do they have internet connection? Do they have a computer? Do they have a stapler? Do they have a pencil? The relationships around them. So the environment, again, positive relationships, people they can lean into, people they can work with. So you focus on, does the person around them have an environment that suits? Then you have the A of team, the actual work that they have to do. And so if they have that, then do they care about the actual work that they have to do? Are they educated enough to do the actual work that you have them do? Is the actual work aligned with their strengths? Does it like lean into those strengths? And then once the actual work is aligned, they have an environment that serves them, they have trust, then you focus on meaning. That's the M, the team model of managing to motivate. Do they care about their work? Do they understand the importance of their work? Do they feel connected to the meaning of their work? Do they understand the meaning and the impact of the broader organization? And so this is a lot for a leader, but really what it comes down to is the environment curated to your employee? You are responsible for that as a leader, not just submitting timesheets, not just checking to see if they scanned in to go into the office, because now you're 4 days in the office. You are responsible for curating that environment to them. And you can do that with the team model of managing to motivate.
How does a leader then start to nurture people or even themselves as they start to go from that doing role? You know, like, they're actually taking part in the projects and working with the team and doing the actual part of the work, I suppose, to then them moving up to that strategic role. And, you know, they have to switch off the autopilot and stop reading the instructions and actually start maybe leading people themselves or, moving up to a point where that happens. Because, like, I'll be honest, it's something I've done personally in the last couple of years. And it's something I've had to kind of reckon with, or a certain part of my role has turned into that. And it's a really difficult transition. And I think it's something everyone tends to go through as they progress in their career. Is that something that you've had to sort of come up with some kind of work-throughs with people as they kind of go through that? And if so, what are some of the steps that people can take?
Yeah, the most common gaps from like an IC, right, individual contributor to a leader, is they direct instead of guide. So they don't coach and they don't connect the strategic vision to the day-to-day work. They're more focused on tactical. And then they aren't visible enough. They're not courageous enough to kind of work cross-functionally across the organization. They kind of stay within their silo and their unit. And then they're not delegating. So coaching, delegating, visibility. And then there's also, and I just keep adding more, they have a hard time giving feedback. Yes, moving from I'm just going to do my work and my work is done, so I did a good job, to I'm now responsible for helping other people do their work, giving them the feedback to do that work, setting expectations, and then aligning that to the broader vision to help them motivate, to help motivate them is really difficult. And it's a transition. Hopefully the organization has some sort of leadership training program. If they don't, give me a call. But yeah, it's a change in rules. It's a change in expectations. It's a change in standards. And it's a change in how we feel good about our work. So you don't get to go into work each day, whatever you did for your routine or your standard, kind of ignore the responsibilities of taking care of others or the broader organization goals. And you just did your projects and then you were done and you went home and you enjoyed your day. It's now very different. Like your dopamine hits have to now come from having a hard conversation with an employee and setting expectations and holding them accountable to timelines. And then your dopamine has to come from guarding a half an hour of your time and sitting back and thinking strategically about the next quarter. It's like the things that you now have to do are different. And sadly, organizations have a hard time explaining that to people that become leaders. And so we either have to do it ourselves by saying, okay, so like my project are these 4 team members. Great. Okay. So then you then structure that. When you're one-on-ones, are you setting expectations? Are you setting timelines? Are you giving feedback, holding people accountable? Are you coaching and teaching instead of directing? Because that leads to greater levels of engagement. So there's so many multiple components to your question. Just know that like if you're a new leader, that this exists, there's this transition, and these are skills you can learn. And so if you are a new leader and you're doubting your own capabilities, then at least spend 1 to 2 hours a day learning about leadership skills. You can start with like a leadership podcast or a leadership book. Like there's so many out there, but you have to make it part of your learning. If you're not learning, you're not growing, you're not going to change your current situation.
I think it's also one of those things, we've only briefly touched on ego, but I think when people do get themselves into a leadership role, sometimes they end up thinking that the growing kind of doesn't need to continue now. They're like, right, I'm at the point where I need to, the student becomes the master, essentially. And they're like, now, I'm no longer the Padawan learner. I don't need to worry about this. I can just give it to them. But actually, from the conversations I've had with people like yourself, it seems that it's the classic jujitsu mentality of like, Black, once you become a black belt, that's when it really starts. That's when it really begins, and it's like, if anything, that's when the learning really starts, is once you now, because suddenly you're not only accountable for yourself, but you're accountable for other people too, which actually makes it even more important that you continue trying to improve it. But I do think a lot of people go the opposite way to that. And they go, oh, well, I'm leadership now. I've completed my own journey of getting to here. And I wonder if that's the case, and something that you've noticed before in the coaching that you've done.
That could be the motivation. And so I'm here now, I don't have to do anything else. But I've seen pervasively at every level, I'm not, going back to like the beginning of this conversation, I'm not responsible for growth and learning. Like it's just going to happen.
Right?
It's just going to happen naturally. And it's someone else's job. I was given this new role. Awesome. That must mean that I'm ready for it. I'm capable for it. The organization, if they want me to do something, they'll tell me. And it doesn't, like, maybe it works like that sometimes, but it's this like sense of like personal accountability that we need to just take in. And can't tell you how many people that I work with, where it's incredible that they've come to hire a coach. It's an amazing, huge step. But I'm their first step. And I'm like, what? Like when I was learning, my first step was typing in to a search bar on the internet, being like, how do I get better at this? And then watching like 20 hours of YouTube videos and then going to do stuff and then reflecting and journaling. So there's this idea of like, okay, personal ownership. And I think coaching creates personal ownership. It shows you that like, oh, you are capable of doing this thing. And a lot of people have this fear because they don't know where to start. They don't know how to start. And they also are afraid they're going to fail. And so they just don't. And that's kind of one of the beauties of coaching.
Speaking of coaching, we've got a couple of questions that we ask every guest at the end of each episode. And the first one, where do you see coaching going in the next 5 years? How do you think the role of a coach is going to evolve as we continue going through a strange time in human history?
Yeah, I got asked to go get certified last year because I get pitched to different consulting running different consulting projects, like I sourced that out. And so it makes me like a stronger pitch if I have the certification. So I'm back at my certification after a decade of coaching. And in that course, we started talking about the future of coaching. It's important. And people are investing all this time and money into getting certified, building a new career, maybe it's in some of these individuals. And it like the kind of a resolution, like the kind of summary of that conversation was coaching, like baseline coaching, just like normal kind of everyday stuff, like AI, tech, it's going to happen. It's taken over. Like, I don't have a lot of limiting beliefs. I just need maybe a plan. I need some accountability. I need to work through some of my emotions. I need to process. AI, amazing, perfect for that. It's great. But then there's some aspect of coaching that's like requires some nuances, like human interaction, greater levels of trust, a sense of bonding and connection. And maybe there are more convoluted situations where someone just doesn't need to know what to do, or doesn't need just to process. They need like a deeper level. That's where coaching is going to be. That's where the value is going to be, that where technology, at least for a little bit of time, isn't going to be able to replace. I think that little bit of time, maybe a little bit longer of a time, where that level of personalization and deepness is going to be the heart of coaching, not the tactical, not the technical, not the processing piece. And there's going to be this split, right? Where maybe every coach has their own AI avatar, where it becomes common and normal. Maybe every person on their phone, instead of Siri or Alexa or Grok or, you know, Claude, it's like, it's your personal mate. And we get bonded with that from birth. You know, like who knows what it's going to be. But hopefully this idea of personal professional development becomes more pervasive, because I think it's pretty niche. And we drop our ego and we all talk about our, you know, my Ben squared today told me, and we feel more common to have that. And in our meetings, maybe there's a meeting coach at every organization and the CEO has their coach. And we'll see. We'll see if we kind of have these agents throughout our life.
It's one of those things, like so many people are so terrified, but maybe it's because I'm just, you know, keyed into it a bit more. But I think it's fascinating. I love the idea of all of us having more help. And, you know, going back to when you were a kid, like how many evenings of a week did all of us have to go to our coach for this or our coach for that? Or, you know, for like, it sounds niche again, but like, couple of years I did like archery. Every Thursday I had an archery coach and I would go and do that. Or my sister had piano lessons. She essentially had a coach with that. You know, my brother played football. I don't know. But like, It was such a normal thing when we were younger. I know obviously it was about sports and things, but as we've got older, it does feel like, you know, the curve has kind of come back around where suddenly all these adults are taking notice of like, huh, maybe it's because life's getting harder. I don't know. But or maybe it's the accessibility piece. But it's so nice to think, you know, down the line, people everywhere and whatever people do for a living or part of life they're in will have access to someone, something that can provide them with some value and some insight of how to improve themselves.
How cool would it be if you were jumping on a surfboard and had a little earbud in your ear being like, a little bit more pressure on your left foot. Yeah. You know, like right now, get up. Like, okay, steady. You know, like how cool would that be?
Yeah, it's a nice feeling. Speaking of that, final question. What area of your life do you feel that you need a coach in?
What area of my life do I need a coach in?
Or are you receiving coaching in?
Yeah. You know what? This is a tough one. I overthink, right? I'm a processor. I'm an analytical. I'm a what to do more, what to do. I need a coach to be like, just be like, hey, just stop. Just stop for a little bit. Just stop. But from a tactical and technical piece, I need a Spanish coach. I have a Spanish virtual teacher. I have an in-person teacher. I have all the virtual stuff, but I need like an immersive AI Spanish coach that I can just kind of walk around with and talk to all day.
My brother's learning Spanish at the moment. And this morning we own a place together and he works on super yachts. He's back at the moment. And I came in and his Spanish teacher told him to watch Shrek in Spanish because apparently Donkey's voice actor is hilarious. So his homework was basically to watch Shrek in Spanish. So I came in to the living room this morning and he just had Shrek on. And it took me a couple of minutes to realize, but yeah, he was watching it in Spanish and yeah, he seemed to quite enjoy it. So maybe that might help you. I don't know. I don't know if your Spanish coach would tell you that, but
yeah, I'll try it out. I watched Puss in Boots the other day in Spanish, so I'll watch
Shrek. Oh, no way.
Yeah, this time.
Go backwards.
Yeah.
Ben, some of your insights are amazing. Like I said, before we hit record, I've been wanting to talk to someone about the career side of things specifically for quite a long time. I think there's so much information out there now about work-life balance and how, you know, you should focus on your life as well and things. But ultimately, like, you know, what we spend, I think they said 30% of our life at work, like it's such a huge part of our lives. And whether it's a good thing or not, we tie so much of our self-worth to it that I think it's an important thing to try and work on and optimize. Where can people go if they want to find out more about what you do?
Yeah, go to liveforyourselfconsulting.com. So liveforyourselfconsulting.com. And also find me on LinkedIn, Dr. Benjamin Ritter. Post pretty regularly. But the website's important though, because you can sign up for some free downloads and guides and the email list and learn about the book and the podcast and all that jazz.
Yeah, we'll have all the links in the show notes below wherever any of you are watching / listening. So yeah, please do make sure you check that out. Yeah, thanks again to Dr. Benjamin for coming on. Thank you to all of you for listening, and we will see you all for the next one.